Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Wow. Saudi Arabia heavyweight boxing, Ngannou versus Joshua. And boom, went the former UFC heavyweight champion from the absolute dynamite of Asia. I'm Brian Campbell of Morning Combat, here to break it down. Welcome into the post-fight analysis show. That was vicious. That was violent. That was unexpected, obviously, in some ways, in the totality of the one-sided nature. For all the thoughts we had coming into this about whether this was about Francis Ngannou's story and how much of that performance last October and a disputed split decision loss to Tyson Fury, Fury being overweight, was, you know, magic, was an aberration, was excuse. Most of us raised, rightfully so, our expectations of what Ngannou could do against Joshua, but styles do make fights. Can't look away from that being a very out-of-shape Fury last fall. And Anthony Joshua, when he acts like that, when he behaves like that, when he speaks like that, when he thinks like that, when he makes ice-cold killer looks like that without celebrating after delivering the boom, he quickly realized it was the wrong guy on the wrong night, and that extremely large gap in true experience and form and technique, which Ngannou was able to, I don't want to say fudge, but not expose himself against Fury because he was limiting himself to just one punch at a time. Again, what ultimately cost him on the scorecards. But this is just a different fight against a different fighter who is more dangerous when he's dialed in, and that's Anthony Joshua. A lot to sort of sort out here in a fight that didn't even last two full rounds, but it's hard to ignore so much of the unknown now moving forward for Francis Ngannou. This is AJ's story. That's what ultimately this fight was about. And it's, you know, I'm not going to meme Ngannou. I'm not going to laugh at him. I mean, that was violent. And I think for a little bit, we were all sort of, praying that he was going to be okay. I mean, they ultimately gave him oxygen and he came back under and stood on his own power. But, you know, I don't even want to do what a lot of boxing folks are doing, fighters, fans, media, and saying, you know, that one was for boxing. No, I mean, what Ngannou did against Fury changed us in a lot of ways, not just our expectations or the respect we had for him. Ngannou's a tough out. You're not going to know that by the way this fight went. And I do think the key technical error and going to that switching stance to southpaw, which isn't something he did a ton in MMA either. Obviously, if your defense isn't up to snuff with your offhand, you can leave that opening. And boy, did he. And ever since that first round right cross, which exposed his inexperience in that stance, landed, boy, was it downhill quick for Ngannou. But before that happened, I think you can make the argument that he actually looked better this time around. He didn't have better success, but I mean, physically, he's always a brick shithouse, as they used to say in my hometown. But he was just that next level. I mean, he looked like a tank out there. Did you see his back muscles? I mean, it was just absolutely ridiculous. And I think he really, in that six-month gap since the fight in October, I think he really stepped up his game. Now, it's hard to make that statement when you see him get ultimately splattered in such debilitating ways and shocking ways, given his history of chin and recuperativeness and inspiration and all of that. But, I mean, these were clean shots off of technical errors that no one's going to withstand. No one's going to get up from. I mean, he got up twice, but ever since the first knockdown, I think it did shake him enough where even though he was able to regroup, he didn't look like he was on spaghetti legs. He wasn't able to regain any form of control. I actually thought he was winning the first round up until that knockdown happened. Not overly impressive, but jabbing to the body. Nice counter left hooks every time AJ tried to jab to the body himself and dipped his head down to his right. Those little counter left hooks were there, shows you a nice wrinkle and improvement. But there was a confidence in Ngannou that I thought the announce team, Todd Grisham leading that all-star cast of big Darren Barker, big British heroes on there, in saying that, you know, was it too confident? Was it too cocky? Well, look, Tyson Fury, you don't want to say he doesn't have big time power. That used to be the reputation of him. But I think since hooking up with Sugar Hill Stewart, his new trainer, and really sitting down on punches, being the bigger fighter, I always say Tyson Fury's fight with Otto Wallin, where he had that vicious cut, where his heavyweight title was, you know, hanging in the balance in the future fights that he was going to have. I think he learned that night how to be 6'9" and lean and lean into your shots and be powerful. And he's turned himself around. We saw that in the second and third Wilder fights into being a big puncher. I mean, if you're 6'9" and you're athletic and you're quick like he is, and you step into one, you can lay somebody out. But he does not or never had the type of power where people go flying. Beautiful knockout of Dillian White, Tyson Fury had on that uppercut inside. But AJ has real ridiculous power, and he has always had. He's always been an incredible finisher with both hands. His uppercuts have been Lennox Lewis-like, and I don't think that's hyperbole. It's just been the disconnect, which started in the first loss to Andy Ruiz, his first loss of his career back in 2019 in MSG. And he never really put Humpty Dumpty back together again. You know, the two Usyk losses, the meltdown after the second fight. I didn't think he'd ever be this guy again. The guy he was against Otto Wallin just in December a few months ago. And then the guy he ultimately was here. But like I said off the top, all the talk that this was going to be Ngannou's story, now we got to figure out if Ngannou's story should continue, you know, in boxing or MMA and combat in general. What will be the long-term physical and psychological damage of a knockout this vicious, this extreme? Dang. I mean, let me catch my breath here. Dang. It felt like a heat check moment, you know, when you're playing NBA Jam, and it doesn't even matter if you're, you know, if you're using true all-stars or some of those bootleg guys they let on there. Remember that time the Mavericks had Mike Isolino, that little white shooting guard from St. Francis College, and he made the NBA Jam game. But if he gets on fire, it's nothing but nylon. It's just going to explode into flames. But inevitably, for the long elongated basketball reference, you got to throw one up from about 30 feet to check if it's real, to check if it's going to last. Whatever magic Ngannou had against Fury, through Fury being unfocused, through that beautiful counter left hand that was delivered beautifully. And I thought David Haye in the lead up to this fight on the DAZN broadcast really spelled out perfectly why Ngannou was dangerous from a technical standpoint in such short time transitioning to the sport, how he was able to turn his punches over and be that powerful. But Styles made fights, and once those mistakes kicked in, and once he realized that the demeanor Tyson Fury seemed to have brought in there in October wasn't as serious as it needed to be. There was pressure on him of will something happen in this fight, a cut, a loss that could ruin his eventual unified super clash, undisputed with Alexander Usyk, which was supposed to be just a few months later. And then we know what happened with the cut to Fury, and now it's delayed to May. But the demeanor of Tyson Fury once he got dropped in round three was survive in advance. It was let's almost curl up into a shell, box jab from the outside, and just, you know, clinch and get out of trouble. The intentions that AJ brought in were of a stone cold killer. And I think in hindsight, you can say, I mean, look, did we overvalue the chin of Ngannou? But I think we came in here with the idea that even with AJ being a puncher, the best bet was the over, that this would go the distance. I believed that not that Ngannou couldn't be knocked out, but we like saw the beating he took for four rounds in the first Stipe fight. We saw, we've seen him get tagged and just shake it off like nothing, like that lead elbow from Tyson Fury in October that was highly illegal and almost seemed to be purposely thrown, and it didn't even shake him at all. And like I mentioned, it's not like Tyson Fury slaps you. When he steps into the punches, they're big. But he's human after all. And when you're going to give openings and make mistakes to somebody like AJ, who can box. I mean, AJ can outbox pretty much every heavyweight not named Usyk or Fury. Can outbox. I mean, he's got those skills. They just weren't super elite, where I think when you add in the knockout loss to Ruiz, and then the fact that I think he just thought, well, when I fight Usyk, man, I'm going to be the better fighter. I'm just going to be the better fighter and outbox him. And it just didn't realize the true skill across from him and the need for him to turn into a different fighter in that moment, to be physical and lean on the smaller heavyweight Usyk, to go to the body, chase him down a corner. I mean, there was some good that AJ did. They were, you know, the first fight was wider than the scores indicated. The second fight, I thought AJ fought a lot better, but I just didn't think he'd ever be that destroyer again. I just never thought he would believe in his power like that again. And it's like, do we credit the 4-day darkness isolation retreat that he went on before the Otto Wallin fight in December with completely changing him? I don't know. I mean, he's different now. He's been real different ever since that meltdown in the second Usyk fight. Obviously, the AJ's different goes all the way back to the Ruiz fight, like I mentioned, but man, those last few fights before the Wallin one, it's like AJ just looked like he didn't know his own identity. He didn't know who he is or who he was supposed to be. And the pressures of being the golden boy for so long, not the Oscar De La Hoya, but the 2012 Olympic gold medalist who, by winning that, ignited a boxing fervor in the UK that is just still on fire today. You know, I mean, Amir Khan gets a lot of credit too, but I mean, Joshua was their guy. It still is. But what he's doing right now, even against Ngannou with the limited ability, I mean, this is like, you know, like Holyfield, like this is what, you know, the greats do. I mean, you can, it's hard to compare guys in different eras and different times at different sizes, right? It's always going to be hard to be, but like, you can only fight who's in your era. Now I believe that up to a certain point, I felt that some people, Dan Rafael included, were almost overvaluing the run Vladimir Klitschko had and piling up all those title defenses, but doing it in the most boring and safe manner by the second half of his career, and just being in an era devoid of danger once he put it together finally. And it's a credit to him for longevity for sure. But, you know, would he have held the belt that long even in this era? No, he wouldn't have. And what AJ's doing to reinvent himself is incredible. He's already a two-time champion. And even though they went ham on the hyperbole afterwards, him as promoter Eddie Hearn, from the standpoint of like, this is the best heavyweight in the world, the most dangerous now. I mean, even though that's hyperbole because he just lost twice to Usyk, who's going to be in the undisputed clash. And I get, and I don't blame him. He's a promoter. Eddie Hearn basically saying, we hope Fury goes out there and beats that guy, Usyk. Well, yeah, because he's not lying when he says Fury Joshua could be one of the biggest fights ever. Now, he's saying it's going to be the biggest fight of all time. I don't believe that, but it'll be freaking massive. I mean, AJ doing 80,000, 90,000 soccer stadiums, him and Fury, whether it's in Jerry World, you know, soccer stadium in the UK, Saudi Arabia for $2 billion or on a helipad. I mean, it's a monster fight with their personalities and the history at stake, but it's actually great for boxing and heavyweight boxing that AJ is able to come back around. Did not think it was possible 3 fights ago. Really didn't. He was still young enough, right? He's only what, like 33, 34, but he had become a malcontent. And once you start changing trainers on the regular, yet each performance, you're not making the positive enough changes to your game while you're changing trainers, it felt like a constant disconnect. Well, whatever he's doing, even though he's still producing cringe post-fight interviews in which sometimes it looks like he's trying to be funny or trying to be hip and cool in ways that he maybe isn't, I'm not going to make fun of him because I want my heavyweight champions to be like that. I want them to believe in their power. I want them to be gunslingers. I want them to do exactly what he did to Ngannou. And in some ways, you know, you can always argue that that was the best strategy. Because, you know, the point I was trying to get to when I talked about Ngannou's chin is we overvalued it in a lot of ways because we've seen him be so superhuman. His story to get here is superhuman. It's incredible, his life story. So,
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But he's human. And if you're going to get a Joshua that's going to run after that, run into that, make that uncomfortable. Fury looked disinterested early, but like I mentioned, when he finally got touched by Ngannou, it was like, oh, crap. Like, this guy not only hits as hard as they say that he does with both hands, but he can find a way to get it to me faster and more technical than I thought he could. And it's not perfectly technical. And those gaps, again, got exposed here in this matchup. But AJ going after him like he did, did he really go after him? I mean, he went after him when he had him hurt. But I think it is that mistake of turning southpaw that was the beginning of the end. It felt like the mistake Weidman made against Rockhold to lose the title. It felt like the mistake Chael Sonnen made in the second Anderson Silva fight, or Stefan Bonner made in the Anderson Silva fight too. It felt like one of those mistakes you don't come back from. I mean, to his credit, Ngannou, who's got such an incredible will, he was able to get up from the first two knockdowns, the second one coming in that second round. But that first knockdown in the second round was absolutely brutal to the side of the ear. That's one of those equilibrium ones that just leaves you a mess. But when Ngannou got up from that second knockdown, the first one in the second round, the finishing shot was just, oh my God. I mean, to hear those announcers say that might be the most brutal right hand knockout shot I've seen live ever. I mean, you're hard pressed when you watch that in slow motion. And when you know the chin of Ngannou, you'd be hard pressed to say you've ever seen one that violent in a fight like this. I mean, you have, obviously. I mean, God, Pacquiao Marquez for anybody, right? I mean, good Lord. But you know, Pacquiao also leaped into that incredibly recklessly and irresponsibly because he was so caught up in the moment there at the end of the round. But I mean, that right cross, you had a hurt Ngannou, got up, you know, equilibrium damage, but it happened so fast before he could even get his full guard up. That right was just, damn. I was on HQ, just CBS Sports HQ, just now with Luke Thomas live. And, you know, he really, you know, I'm the one afterwards who's trying to fantasy matchmake and go, okay, I know Ngannou just got derailed, but like, him against Deontay Wilder still kind of makes sense, right? It's big money. Somebody's getting knocked out. It's the two biggest punchers in combat sports history. And Deontay Wilder just looked in December against Joseph Parker like he shouldn't even be in the ring anymore. That's the carny mind of my pro wrestling matchmaking heart. But what Luke said, the reality of the severity of a knockout like that is massive. I mean, he was knocked the hell out. They didn't show the replay for a long time for a reason. They had to kind of revive him with the oxygen. It was tough to see. Knowing Francis' story, it was hard not to cheer for him from a sporting standpoint, from a human interest standpoint. And he's not dead, but you wonder what this does to the psyche. Now, he's got a psyche and a will and a ability to rebound in ways that like regular humans are never going to understand, right? But still, there's a tax to pay for a loss like this. And sometimes it is to make you a little bit gun shy. I mean, he was maybe a little bit too confident in the first round. Maybe Ty Grisham was right, you know, too confident to switch and kind of leave himself open. But the errors he made in round two that set up these two big shots, they were him lunging, leaning, really just trying to shake the cobwebs, regain himself. But in his attempts to do that, just slightly off the beat. And if you're slightly off the beat against somebody like AJ, who does have, you know, really good technique, again, he's not going to outbox Fury or Usyk. And that was a tough pill for him to swallow twice against Usyk, but he's going to outbox anybody else. And he learned on the job, you know, he didn't pick up the sport. I mean, AJ is a really remarkable story. And I know that he's given a lot of people reason to kind of turn on him and not like him. And he did sound like a heel at times in that post-fight interview. But the reason why I won't crap on him for it is because, like, Stella got a groove back here. You know what I mean? Like, he deserves to take that sort of victory lap. Only he really didn't, which I respected. And maybe it was out of the fear of him knowing just how big that punch was that dropped and finished and knocked out cold Ngannou. And the fact that he said afterwards that, you know, he broke bread with Ngannou. It seems like it's really hard to hate Francis Ngannou, right? If you meet him, if you interview him, if you read about him. I mean, you know, Dana's really upset at him that he chose to stay with the $600,000 for the Cheryl Gane fight so he can get out of his contract rather than accept the $5 million, which comes with that, right? The renegotiated super long restrictive deal. I mean, look at the bags, multiple bags he has been able to take home. I'm sure he'll end up with one fight in the PFL at least, right? And I'm sure there's big bags to take home there. But, like, I don't want to rush him back into the boxing ring despite that Deontay Wilder matchup idea or the PFL smart cage without making sure that he wants to continue to do this. I think he will, though, because of the competitor in him and because the class thing that AJ did afterward. Oh, to finish my thought on AJ, when he knocked him out cold, it was ice cold from AJ. But I think some of that was posturing because that's the new demeanor that he's operating under. But some of that was also like, you know, I had to do him dirty, and that's another human who I respect. But yeah, it seems like nobody can say a bad thing for a reason about Francis Ngannou. So I want to give him his space, recover from this. But AJ showed a lot of class afterwards when he went to the well many times in telling Francis, his team, and the audience that this guy shouldn't be done. You got to come back. You're good. Like, you'll beat many people. And I actually believe that if he wants to. More than I even did when I wrote in a post-fight column after Mayweather McGregor. Now we sort of, like, all these years later, we almost really poo-poo Conor's efforts. And maybe some of that is because of the changing, evolving narrative. And, you know, people in Floyd's team told me this after the fight that, oh, he didn't really actually train that hard. Like, how that played out was exactly what he was trying to do. Read the potentially dangerous opponent, let him get tired out, and then, you know, put the pressure on him, walk him down, rely on your, you know, huge built-in advantages and knowledge and experience and all that. But I remember after that fight going, you know, if Conor really wanted to, but it would be a long road. But if he really wanted to, he did seem to have certain instincts that were very good. Now, I still to this day wonder, for all the hype talk we said about, well, McGregor's got that one punch power and Floyd's 40. And obviously that was to sell it, but to some degree, because McGregor hadn't outlived his magic yet. I had not lived that run where anything felt possible. You almost talked yourself into it, or you wanted to talk yourself into that idea that he could do that. But no, the power didn't transfer. The power didn't carry. Even that really nice left uppercut to the Adam's apple of Floyd in round one that he hit didn't really seem to rough Floyd up. Well, yeah, Francis is a lot different because his power is so absurd that, you know, you wonder in almost a Deontay Wilder-like sense, even if he didn't work on his craft and just went out there and relied on the power, could he still beat a lot of guys? He probably could, but he might, if he can recover from this physically and mentally in a way that keeps him the same level of motivated and, you know, how much did he lose on the odometer here at 37 with this type of devastation? I don't know. But if he wants to come back, his skills are, you got to give him credit. You got to give credit to Dewey Cooper, Eric Nixick, the extended team there. Shout out to Snapchat Randy. I mean, you got to give credit all the way around. It's not good enough to beat AJ, and it got exposed against AJ 100%. But there's very few heavyweights that are Fury, Usyk, and this version of AJ, right? I mean, Joseph Parker looked great tonight against Zhang Zhilei, who knocked Parker down twice. Okay, didn't look great. He got knocked down twice. But Zhang Zhilei did bang, bang, zang things where he kind of didn't have the stamina to finish the job or even give himself a true argument to win the fight. But in this renaissance era of heavyweight that I always brag about, because the Klitschko run was so difficult to watch as excitedly, right? But when Fury upset Klitschko in 2015, it changed. You could feel it changing. And then we were like, wow, if all these guys could end up being good, Wilder, Joshua, Fury, oh my God, one day Usyk might go to heavyweight. And, you know, there were other guys around. Joseph Parker was one of them back then. He was a big-time prospect and, you know, won the title early. What did he beat? Tyson Fury's cousin, Huey, I believe, for the belt in a majority decision, and beat Andy Ruiz, too, in a much earlier version of him. But the Renaissance era is more about fights that matter. Now, it does turn out that we're getting all-time greats. I'm not here to tell you that, like, this Usyk, Fury, Joshua trio with Wilder, that, like, these four kings, if you will, are, you know, better than Ali, Norton, Frazier, Foreman, or even the great 90s group that I just mentioned, which also included, by the way, Mike Tyson and Dan George Foreman and Michael Moore to go along with Bo, Holyfield, Lewis, Tyson again, Ray Mercer. I mean, just the 90s and the 70s were incredible. But, like, the rest of boxing history has always been shallow heavyweight divisions. I mean, we always put that tag on what the UFC used to be. Well, kind of still is today in terms of a lack of extended depth. it's hard. It's hard to find, you know, 10, 15 all super elite title worthy world class contenders at any point in either sport at heavyweight. It's difficult in that regard. But is Ngannou ready to beat a second tier guy right now like Joseph Parker? I mean, probably not. But like I said, the step down below AJ, Fury, well, you know, what Wilder used to be, Usyk, obviously, it can be steep. It can be hit or miss. I mean, you know, Bang Bang Zhang, Zhang Zhilei looked great in turning his career around and twice knocking out Joe Joyce to win that secondary title that he lost tonight. But, you know, he looked like a mess for most of his career before that, gassing out all the time. Remember, he dropped Jerry Forrest three times, but couldn't finish him off. Ended up settling for a draw because he gassed out so hard. He nearly died afterwards. And they found out he was so dehydrated because he said, I didn't drink water. I didn't know I was supposed to as a boxer. Like, heavyweight division's wild. And Ngannou, I think, could, if he wanted to. Is he hits hard enough and has a sturdy enough foundational base. It's unorthodox, as we saw against Fury, but it works. They've adapted. They've made it work. Again, I liked a lot of the body language and the movement and the fluidity of Ngannou in the first 2 minutes of that first round before he switched stances and destruction came. But I don't know if that's the right move for him. You could do big money fight against Wilder. You could eventually do a rematch against Fury, you know, especially if Ngannou decided he wanted to step down considerably and start building back up, you know, maybe show up on the next Saudi card in the co-main or one of the earlier fights for less money, but to gain that experience. If he wanted to, I actually think he could. So, which goes back to my original opening thing of, we were trying to figure out when handicapping this fight, how much was a fluke in that first fight? How much was it the fat Fury? It's like a little bit of both. It's like a little bit of both. We did see an Ngannou who, he might not be Bo Jackson, but he's way better than he should be, without question. He's a freak. He's an absolute freak. I kind of want to see what he has if he wants to. It is more intriguing right now than what's available at the PFL. It just is. Henan Fajita just, you know, knocked out Ryan Bader, you know, brutally, and I would like to see that fight, but you know, is that a marquee pay-per-view? How much is the PFL happy because this looks like it could be the end of Francis's boxing career? Or is the PFL, does this damage Francis's brand for what the PFL wants to do? That's all interesting questions. Does this make him a vulnerable MMA fighter now because he has not fought an MMA since what, January of 22 against Ciryl Gane? Yeah, it has been a long time. There are a lot of questions. I don't know. I don't know what Francis does next, but if I did have to guess, I know the heart in him. I do think he comes back. I do think what he said leading up to this fight about, you know, I'm only just beginning. I think AJ's right. If you wanted to continue to add to this, even at 37, we don't worry about that age as much. I mean, look at what George Foreman did at 45. Look at what Mike Tyson's trying to do at 58. A lot of people criticizing me for you know, almost supporting that fight. I guess I just sort of, nothing, I mean, this one surprised me, but like nothing surprises me anymore in combat sports, especially in this era of crazy crossover, ridiculous YouTubers that, damn, that's brilliantly matched. I mean, it is, it's brilliantly matched, but we do have a lot of interesting stuff going on in the regular heavyweight division where we don't need that. We've got Fury Usyk coming up. We've got in May 18th. We've got a rematch after that. I mean, you just saw Joseph Parker kind of put himself back on the map. You have Filip Ergovic, who's the number one contender for Usyk's IBF title and will become the IBF champion after the first Fury Usyk fight, because then he'll be contractually, you know, he's taking step aside money, but he's no longer going to do that. So Usyk will be stripped regardless. But AJ reviving himself, as I said earlier, is just monumental for boxing right now. It's great. You know, you would want your big pillars and stars to be able to reload, regroup like this. He is back. He is back, and I do think it's Ben Davison. And it doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, Ben Davison had a lot of success and was a big part of Tyson Fury coming back from near death and depression and obesity and all of that. But then Fury kind of kicked him to the side and said, you did good, but I do need this change. I need to be more offensive. I need to be the Kronk style. And in the end, you know, it served him very well. But Ben Davison is a good fighter, technically, defensively, seems to get on, even though he's very young, right? He was like 25 when he was training Fury. He's the wunderkind. He seems to get along well with the fighters. AJ's in the spot where he was sort of satellite still connected with Derek James, but Derek James is very busy. Now he's got Ryan Garcia. And I think the comfortability of being there with Ben Davison the first time last fight, I think he's pushed old Derek James to the side. And he did the same thing to Robert Garcia, to Virgil Hunter. I mean, he's bounced around lately. But Oscar De La Hoya used to bounce around a lot too, particularly in the second half of his career. And sometimes, you know, Miguel Cotto too, to some degree. But when Miguel Cotto found Freddie Roach, it just locked and it worked. And when Oscar De La Hoya found Floyd Sr., it just worked. It was somebody that just motivated him, didn't take shit. It just, you know, had the right thing to say, pushed him in different areas, expanded and enhanced certain parts of his game. That's that connection with Ben Davison is nasty. And I think it's done a lot mentally, along with whatever the changes AJ's gone through personally to sort of rewire and reload. It's working. It's working. That Fury fight, if Fury gets through Usyk twice, it's a big one. That's what we want. I mean, that's one of those era defining fights. We're gonna have an undisputed champion soon for a minute, and then that belt's gonna go over to Filip Bergovich. But all right, enough babbling here, okay? Had a good time talking to you. Thank you. MK Forever, big news next week. Thank you. UFC 299 Saturday night, post-show. Here, don't miss it. Luke Thomas, you'll see him. I am BC, but I'm out of here, all right? I mean, that was kind of gross. It was well-timed, but it was – I mean, it was enough. This has to be the